The storytellers take the stage and the page. From SDPB, today is Friday, October 4th. This is In the Moment. We begin this hour with the story of a West River ranch hand down on his luck and looking for redemption on the prairie. South Dakota's poet laureate joins us with The Odyssey of Earl. Then, what's so funny about divided, crabby voters? Humorist Dorothy Rosby performs an electorate essay and will preview an upcoming stage reading of her holiday humor. Then the fiddles are on fire and the witches are whirling. The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra performs classical music with a story to tell. We'll bring you tales of human drama from the delirium of an opium high to the lessons of a folktale. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Bruce Roseland, South Dakota's poet laureate, has released a new book. It's called Earl's Own Dakota Odyssey. Think of it as a West River epic packaged into a free verse novella. Let's let Bruce Roseland introduce Earl.
Earl's Own Dakota Odyssey. And we begin in the beginning, which is on page one. Earl begins. Earl was born on a cold November morning, the kind that has icicles, a foot of snow, and grows into what folks refer to as a hard winter, picking the year of his birth as a rough one. There he grew up on the wrong side of the tracks of a small Dakota town where the railways were pulled up just about as soon as they were laid down. Not that they ever made much difference. His father had drifted off like an autumn tumbleweed, leaving no tracks. And for Earl, no memories. His mother made do on black and white TV, slits, and welfare. One and done, she told everyone, with a nod at Earl. So Earl, too, made do, too. Watching older men take care of their idle time, drinking beer, clinking pool balls under neon ham signs, listening to them talk girls. The early childhood education that took hold in this one-room pool hall school, delivering a hitting, frequently missing alternative set of learning. High school in a nearby, slightly bigger town with a blur, sitting in the back of class, laughing at others' sass, nodding off, waiting for lunch, and 4 years ticking by, ending with an unsigned diploma and a quick handshake. Walking across the auditorium stage was Earl's one and only achievement, other than the senior year third-string bench warmer on a losing football team. Hard to belong where there is no belonging. Just release at being released. Free at last on a warm spring day. Not a clue as to what to do and no skills to do it with. The open road with a big blank page. Like a tumbleweed, Earl rode out of town. So that is the beginning of Earl as he ventures forth into West River, South Dakota, into various adventures.
In the introduction of the book, you talk about meeting somebody out on the highway, which many of us have done in South Dakota. We've either been pulled out of ditches or we've pulled people out of ditches. Tell me how you came up with this idea for really a novella in verse.
Well, first things first, and that is I always wanted to write a story. Now, the stuff I write is free verse poetry, and usually my stories are done in a page or so. But I never really could think of something to write about, and I call myself an accidental writer, which I am. Things just accidentally happen in my life, and then I just write about it. That's the deliberate part. But Earl just set off a chain of, it took a little while, it took about 8 months, but it set off a chain of thought in me. There was just something about Earl that reminded me of so many people. I was driving down the road back on a winter day, and I was driving into the sunset, and I saw somebody waving frantically at me from a ditch. So I couldn't leave them. You know, it's the West River Highway, not a lot of traffic. So I backed up, and this guy came up, and, you know, he looked like 40 going on 70, smoking a Camel Straight, kind of haggard looking and, you know, thin. And anyway, he asked me if I had a toe strap or something to pull him out. So I said, yeah. So I walked down into the ditch. And, you know, here was this beat-up pickup in the windshield. You know, he had a five-foot chain. He, talk about optimistic. He's sitting there with a five-foot-long chain waiting for somebody to pull him out of the ditch. Anyway, the windshield is caved in, you know, and spider-cracked like crazy. In the middle of the, on the driver's side, was a fist-size hole in the windshield with a red bandana stuck in it. So that's how he's driving down the road. And the pickup had obviously been in a rollover, but not there, because the tracks were just straight into this knee-deep snow ditch. So anyway, I go about to pull him out. And I tell him, take it slow, take it easy. That's how you pull people out of the ditch. Well, he guns it. And so he's whipping back there, fishtailing. And when I first start out, you know, there's no traffic on the highway. Well, by the time he gets out on the road, slingshot out on the road, here there's come semi coming down on me. And I think I closed my eyes. But somehow a catastrophe did not happen. And I get out and I get my toe strap. And, you know, I don't know if we said 15 words to each other. I get in my vehicle and I drive off. He drives off. And I get to thinking, there's a story here. You know, obviously he came from someplace. He's going to someplace. I did write like 3 pages about that. But what struck me about his character was he was so cheerful. This was just another day in his life. You know, I mean, he's just, yeah, no big deal. We just handle things. So about 8 months later, as I was driving from the Cheyenne River Breaks to Union Center, which I drive back and forth quite a bit from my spearfish home to my ranch, and Earl got in the my pickup with me. I'm by myself. And started telling me his life story. You know, not a real Earl, real person, but it was like the combination of all the Earls I ever knew, and it was like a voice inside my head. And he told me some of his life story. And I went home, and I wrote it down pretty much verbatim. And then, you know, a couple weeks later, I'm driving back on the same stretch of road, and, well, he sits in again, tells me more of his story. Well, this happened about, four times. And, that ended up being Earl. I had it all wrote in about 2 months. And it was, then I realized what he was telling me was it was an odyssey, his odyssey, a South Dakota story, a West River story. So that was the whole thing. And I realized it was kind of unique. I write in free verse form, and you rarely ever come into a story written this way. Well, it's a little over 13,000 words, 70-some pages, and there's an arc to the story. So that's Earl, and I think it says a lot about a slice of South Dakota life that, you know, ranch hands.
Yeah. And in that vein, I'm wondering if you could read something that I ask you to read here.
What?
And that's on page 31, the chapter about working cattle. I think it's a particularly effective way to show the character, but then also to show who you are as a poet, as a writer, and as a rancher. Would you read that those three pages for me? We'll sit back and listen.
Okay. Working cattle. Spring always came too quickly when the work began again in earnest. A season of caring for, moving around newborn calves, taking those calves to mothers, moving to new pairs from wooden creek sheltered lot to more open, but still shelter small pastures, where the little bunches grew to the numbers needed to make up the big summer pastures of thousands of acres that lay west of the breaks. When only a few tail enders were left, extra help was called in from the neighboring ranches. Real cowboys, 20 or more, chaff, spurs, and horses, would trailer up before dawn, saddle up, ride out, bring the herds into the sprawling corrals not used since fall. They would let the mamas out one gate and proceed to rope the babies one by one, dragging them bawling to a waiting crew. Couple of guys, one on the front feet, one on the rear feet, stretched the calves out, keeping sharp hooves from flying into cowboys' tender parts. One cowboy clipping budding horns, another hand turning bulls into steers with a snip snip. Vaccine guns flew in and out, touching hide briefly, giving spring shots, keeping these babies free from disease. Then comes a slap of a hot iron, a cloud of burning hair, and a legal brand made to deter rustling thieves. A latex colored marker down the calf's back signified this little critter done and scampering off, not so much worse for wear, back into the nursing mom. Of course, someone with ink and paper wrote all these things down. Serious business, all this, the beginning of filling the ranch's bank account. Earl, over the years, worked his way up to being the hand in charge of vaccine guns instead of his starting out task of throwing a squirming, kicking calf flat to the ground, holding rear legs and tail, his own butt firmly in the dirt, leaning back, grasping the calf's leg, never daring to let go before all done, and risk the wrath of a half a dozen grown men interrupted from assembly line work of coordinated cowboy work. Earl was always mindful where the gun needles went, having once stuck himself in the leg with a dose of 7-way vaccine, having a big knot swell up, long time before it went down. Better the lesson learned by him than sticking a cowboy who would never forget or forgive. Lunchtime and the end of the workday, home-cooked food, and a cooler beer gave Earl a sense of fitting in. These were his kind of folks. After a day or two of resting up cows and calves and home crew, the collected herd would each trailer a slow walk to their summer pasture, turning out the greening grass and pretty prairie flowers. Earl then would go back to his summer-fall routine, tending miles and miles of solitary fence lines, carrying a spool of barbed wire stretchers and cutters, and drive real slow at a beat-up pickup truck, who radio stayed on the same country western station. Frequently, Earl parked his truck way out, where there was no one but cows in the distance, put his boots up through the passenger side open window, leaned back his head upon his rolled-up jacket and took a long snooze. No worries. No one yammering at him about anything. Just butterflies and the prairie breeze. What was not to like with blue sky, floaty, puffy clouds drifting slowly west to east. The smell of western wheatgrass and gama grass ripening in the summer air with a hint of sage. Some folks might have gotten lonely, but Earl knew his was a good gig. He always managed to start up the truck, finish the fence line repairs, make it back to the bunkhouse before dark. Then after supper, step out the front, look at the glittering multitude of stars, count each night of this as luck.
That's Bruce Roseland, South Dakota's poet laureate, reading a bit from his new story, Earl's Own Dakota Odyssey. Bruce, it strikes me that I haven't had too many poetry collections or books come across my desk that have a character like Earl taking center stage. His is a story that often goes untold. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah. I've met a lot of Earls in my life, and that's what I did. I put bits and pieces. This is a combination of stories that have been told, people I've known, and my own inside knowledge. I know a little bit, since I'm a rancher, mm-hmm. how cattle auction barns work. And you just heard about branding and, you know, how you put cattle out to pasture and everything. There's a rhythm to the whole setup. And it's you end up being skilled in a lot of things that you will not learn in a school. The story of Earl is that he takes to this, and he ends up learning skills that takes him through the rest of the book.
Let's do one more. If you would, page 45. This is a shorter one, and it's called Consequences. It's right after a little bit of a bar fight. There's a brawl, and Earl is understanding that there are consequences to Saturday night activities.
Yeah, I should mention Earl does meet the love of his life, and this book is in a way a love story. After one unfortunate night at the local watering hole, he gets into a fight and he gets the worst end of it. So his buddies take him back to the bunkhouse called Consequences. Earl, for the second time, woke up on the bunkhouse floor, his bunk above his head. He put a tentative hand to a swollen jaw and found a few gaps where teeth had been. He heard through the grapevine, many years later, Jill had ditched lover boy, gone to college, married a dentist, and had 5 kids, and was elected president of the local PTA. Women are too complicated, Earl sighed, and he found himself staying close to home on Saturday nights, nursing long-neck bottles of Budweiser, watching the fuzzy old color TV, trying to bring in Austin City Limits. That was Earl's one attempt. Well, it wasn't really his attempt. He had, like I said, an unfortunate night at a bar, and apparently the girl that hit on him, her boyfriend was the jealous type, yes.
Earl's in trouble in a lot of this book, and he's on the run. And without giving too much away about how the Odyssey ends, there's also hope in this book that there is a skill set, connection, relationships for Earl with not only human beings, but with the grasslands of South Dakota as well.
Yeah. I think Earl is a study in that, you know, if you just kind of wander through life, things happen to you. But what the Earl finds redemption because he finally takes responsibility and good things happen after that. So that's the story of Earl.
Bruce Roseland is South Dakota's poet laureate. His latest book is called Earl's Own Dakota Odyssey. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Tomorrow, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra returns with its season opener. Symphony Fantastique is Saturday, October 5th, 7:30 p.m. local time at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. Maestro Delta David Geyer joins us today. He is the music director and conductor for the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. Julian Bodewin is also with us. He is the symphony's guest narrator, and he's the executive director of the South Dakota African American History Museum and co-founder of The Hub SD. Here is Maestro Geyer with a preview of Symphony Fantastique.
So the whole program actually is about storytelling. So we start off with a Carmen Fantasy, which is a piece for solo violin, and Rachel Barton Pine is our soloist, fantastic violin soloist. But the Carmen Fantasy is tunes from the opera Carmen, the ultimate femme fatale. And these will be tunes that everybody will recognize. But then she'll also play this narrated piece by Wynton Marsalis, The Fiddler and the Dancing Witch. So we asked Julian to come be our narrator. Rachel will play a solo violin part with the orchestra as well.
So Rachel is the fiddler?
Yep.
Okay. Who's the witch?
That would be Julian.
Julian, this story, this Wynton Marsalis, you can find a recording of it. He's telling a story, but then the orchestra is playing. If you've heard Peter and the Wolf, there's some similarities in the sense that there's spoken word, and then the music tells the story as well. Where do you approach this narration from?
You know, I have a background from Louisiana, so I'm going to try my best to, you know, channel my inner Cajun, if you will. the witch, for sure, we were talking about this earlier, the witch will be a little bit more difficult to work with. But I want to maybe just back up a little bit and talk about the how you started off with trouble, trouble, and more trouble. That's actually my favorite part of the piece. Is there's an intersection called trouble. And for me, it reminds me of causing good trouble and then being able to come together as a community after trouble is over. And so this piece just, it really ties it in. I mean, you'll hear like during trouble where it feels like chaos at some point, and then it just, right at the end of the chaos, it's so relaxing because you can take a deep breath, a sigh of relief almost.
Yeah. So this is the story of a young boy who falls in love with music as he hears his father playing music. He wants to play the fiddle. His father says, no, it's not for you. It's a magic fiddle. And your ears are for listening to your elders. And of course, as in every good story, Samin is not going to listen to his elders. Yeah. And he's going to pick up that fiddle that happens to belong to a witch at one point in its history. Talk about the musical narrative storytelling. Because I feel like it's somewhat more intuitive to think about how words tell us stories because we all grew up with that. Maybe we have to think a little harder to think about how an orchestra can also move a story forward?
Yeah, well, I mean, the piece is by Wynton Marsalis. So Wynton, he was, for decades now, he's known as a trumpeter. When I was growing up as a trumpet player myself, he was playing classical concertos with orchestras all over the place as a young man, went right out of Juilliard. But he was also a jazz player. So that crossover was kind of unusual. And he's continued to do both, but he's also the director of jazz at Lincoln Center. He has the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, and he composes a lot in the jazz vein. And he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer for the things he's done for orchestra. So he's quite diverse in what he does. But ultimately, he's a great storyteller through music. And as Julie and I were just rehearsing together, it's like, well, your narration can feed off of the music because the music gives the character of all of it, whether it's this, you know, sort of laid back, you know, Simeon, the young boy, is sort of devil may care kind of attitude and his father, but trying to hammer home to him that, you know, you're walking into danger. And then the witch shows up. She really brings the trouble and the chaos and all of that. And so, yeah, you can hear it all in the fiddle and the orchestra. It's really well done.
My favorite part is the part, Julian, where the witch says, your daddy took that fiddle from me. And he says, my dad is an honest man.
That's right.
And if he took this, he must have done it honestly.
Yep.
And I will get it back honestly and with integrity.
Right.
What is that? That part to me just makes me a little emotional. The moment where the boy who was defying his father says, I know that my dad is honest.
Well, I think there's a lesson to be learned in that because part of what he said or part of what the witch said was, I'm going to get my fiddle back. Yeah. And when Simeon said, no, because my dad is honest and has integrity, if you get it back, you're going to have to do so the same way. Mm-hmm. So for me, what that means is that he was taught the right way. Although he might have slipped up. Again, just like in the mix of chaos, sometimes you slip up, sometimes you can't see, you don't have a clear vision for whatever the future is, but man, afterwards you can certainly take a deep, deep sigh of relief. And on that note, you know, during this entire thing, the dad comes in and the dad is like, oh my God, what is my son into? What has he gotten himself into?
Yeah.
And then he begins to somewhat wrap his arms around his son and say, okay, I got your back. The lessons that I've taught you are going to have to carry you through this thing. I'm here standing with you, standing on side of you. So let's get through this together.
Yeah. And what do we do after things settle?
Yeah.
So broaden this out to more of a community conversation then, Julian, because a story is always more than a story.
Absolutely. So for me, particularly right now, and this is me personally, particularly right now when we talk about the chaos of politics and the discussion on the national level and, you know, what happens if one candidate wins, what happens if the other candidate loses, it's a sense of chaos in everyone's minds. And we have to bring it right back home to South Dakota to say what benefits us, what doesn't benefit us, how can we help our neighbors? Because there's a sense of a neighborhood in this story as well. So what can we do to help our neighbors breathe that sigh of relief? And whatever that is, we have to take the step forward to just be helpful, just to be good people.
Yeah. And there are ways that we do that through the orchestra and the community programming that you do. But I want to talk a little bit about the hub and some of the work that you do in the community separate from this this event, this performance. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about the hub and some of what's coming up for that organization, too.
Yeah. So the hub is proud to work alongside business entities in Sioux Falls, particularly. To where we bring business resources to BIPOC entrepreneurs and business professionals. But one event that we're doing is more of a workforce development type event where we've partnered with other nonprofits, and it's going to be on October 10th over at the Union Gospel Mission. It's a day from start to finish of service for our houseless community. And so we'll start off with some grooming techniques such as hair care, some hygiene. There'll be some feminine products available for those there. And then we're going to have business owners from downtown come in, meet the houseless community, be able to sit down, grab a meal with them that'll be provided by Swamp Daddies, and then go through a mock interview process so that they can understand how to develop themselves through more professional development, if you will. And then after we eat, we're going to go from mock interviews directly into real interviews that will hopefully get them job placement.
Fascinating. Who's all involved in this? Who's all coming together to make this happen? And how do you build those collaborations?
Yeah. You know, there are probably 30 to 40 different nonprofits that answer to the call. So I put out an email, just a mass email to about 100, 120 people or so, and about 35 to 40 people responded to that. I know the symphony's going to be involved. They'll be there helping out as well. But, man, it's too many to name, I'll tell you that. Yeah. But what I will say is that's the sense of community that we have in Sioux Falls. When there is an issue that arises, we stand up in the face of adversity.
Maestro, let's talk for people who have, you know, had the summer off. Or there's a new season of the symphony. Mm-hmm. It's about much more than going to a concert. So let's talk about the concert and the opening of it. The talks beforehand, to sort of if you're new to the orchestra, what extra you might want before you sit down in the seat, and then let's move into a little bit about the orchestra as a cultural organization for the state of South Dakota.
Well, I mean there's a lot of resources available for people. I mean, there's Boku stuff on our website, program notes, all of that sort of stuff. There's a pre-concert talk, 1 hour. So 6:30 on Saturday night, and that's included with the price of your tickets. And Julian will be joining me, as will Rachel Barton Pine, our violin soloist, to talk about it. So it's, you know, this is just an easier way to get into the evening. I don't say this about every concert, because some concerts are maybe a little more challenging than others for people who are not familiar with classical music. This one is quite user-friendly. It's not a pops concert. It's all classical music. But you'll hear a lot of familiar music on it. And like I say, it's all about storytelling. And the music is very colorful. The piece on the second half is Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique, which for 200 years has been just a marvel in our world and an audience favorite. It's big, it's powerful. Also tells a story, which I will delineate for the audience before we play it. Just as much access as we can possibly give to people. So I always say that in terms of serving the community, the best thing that a symphony orchestra can do is to play great music in the concert hall. I mean, that's what we exist for. We play 400 years worth of music, and you just don't get that anywhere else. It's a treasure trove of the greatest music that survived for hundreds of years now. So that's the first thing we can do. But then how do we serve the community outside of the concert hall? So we have things like our Lakota Music Project. We have our full-time musicians, our string quartet, woodwind quintet that are out across the state playing in schools, you know, on reservations, you know, Dakota Abilities, McCrossin Boys Ranch. These are all ways that we can, you know, really reach into the community and have an impact. A lot of teaching, our youth orchestra program, all of that is, like, we're very conscious also about each and every main stage concert we do, we try to attach it with partnerships in the community, such as with the Hub, the African American History Museum, with this piece. We did it a year ago. We had a major piece by an African American composer. We did that. But, you know, we have, you know, like Giants in the Earth is coming up at the end of this season, a resurrection of this opera that's been lost for the last 70 years by a major American composer. And we'll record it, but it tells the story of the Norwegian immigrants coming to right where we live right now. So this is We're working with Augustana on this. We have, you know, several concerts. We're working with USD, SDSU, high schools as well, middle schools, curriculum, tying the music in with cross-curricular study. So we put a lot of effort into trying to make sure that what we do is actually relevant to people's lives.
And speaking of the opera that's lost, we should say that this is the Fiddler and the Witch is a world premiere.
That's true, this weekend.
We've heard the recording, but it's never been performed live. How is that possible that Wynton Marsalis was not doing this all over the country at some point?
Well,
it's happening right here in South Dakota.
That's right. I mean, it's sat on the shelf for 20 years, this piece.
The Fiddler and the Dancing Witch is the correct title.
That's okay. Right. Mm-hmm. So Wynton composed this for Joshua Bell, the violin soloist. And Josh, he recorded it with the Orchestra of St. Luke's 20 years ago, but they never performed it live, so which is kind of crazy.
All right. If I would have heard storytelling as a child, it would have most likely been on a record because I lived in rural northwest Iowa for a while, and we would have put records on that my parents would have bought us. Mm-hmm. And then when I got older and moved to town, it would have been at the public library. Mm-hmm. In Louisiana, Julian, where would you have heard a story? Where would somebody have been telling you a story?
Well, so forgive me when I say this. I'm a little bit younger, so I probably would have heard it on a CD. That might have been the first place I heard
You're forgiven. You are younger than I am. Facts are facts. We stand with the truth here.
But you know, stories like this, quite honestly, I probably would have heard it from my orchestra director, Christine Jobert. So yeah. I played violin growing up during school and finished during high school. But Christine Jobert was our director, and she was quite the storyteller herself. I mean, it was quite a bit different. She liked to put her own nudge on things, but she enjoyed really giving us the history of pieces prior to performing them. So we had a proper understanding of what we were doing.
Nice. So that orchestra education is still impacting you today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm proud to say my daughter just picked up a violin, too. So
nice. Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Let's talk about Symphonie Fantastique and the story behind that, because that's a barn burner right there.
It totally is.
This is a fever dream, a delirium, an opium trip. Yeah. What exactly is happening here with this piece?
Well, I'll tell the fuller story on Saturday night before we play the piece with some musical examples, but you got this young composer, Hector Berlioz, in Paris, who is infatuated with this woman, who, and his love is unrequited. So what's he going to do? He's going to write a symphony about it, and he's going to make her the main character. And first it's his, you know, sort of delirious love for this person, but then he gets rejected, and so he goes on an opium trip. As one does.
Is this common in Paris at the time?
I guess. I mean, literally 200 years ago, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So, So he does that, and he has visions of March to the Scaffold, and he has visions of being, you know, led into hell, and finds his beloved there, and she's transfigured into this grotesque creature. And
more witches.
More witches. There you go. You know what? It's actually called The Witch's Sabbath, the last movement. So that's I didn't even think about that. Fiddler and the Dancer's Witch.
More witches.
Yeah, more witches, yeah.
Welcome to October. Yeah, and a good story often has a good witch, right?
It's true, right?
And the theme of wanting something, desiring something you are not supposed to have, a fiddle, and you know, in a children's story, it might be a fiddle to be an adult when you're not quite ready to be an adult. And in this story, to have a partner that you're not quite ready to have. And there are consequences to both of these things, and those consequences are dire.
Indeed.
Musically.
They are.
This is why we make art, because it reflects the human experience.
That's right.
Listen well, and perhaps you'll have good trouble, but stay out of the trouble. That I found this online that Bernstein had said about Berlioz. He tells it like it is. Now that was an honest man. You take a trip, you wind up screaming at your own funeral. Does that sound accurate to you?
Yeah, he actually said that at a young people's concert.
At a young people's concert. <That's> So say no to drugs, say no to
opium. That's exactly right. It was in the 60s, you know? It was like,
Just say no.
Right.
Take a trip, wind up screaming at your own funeral. There's a little poetry in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Symphonie Fantastique is Saturday, October 5th at 7:30 p.m. local time. It's at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. And the event that Julian Baudouin mentioned is Thursday, October 10th from 10 to 1 at the Union Gospel Mission. It's a workforce development event for unhoused people in the area that includes grooming techniques, mock interviews, and then real interviews. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. You may have come across Dorothy Rosby's humor column in your local newspaper. Perhaps you found her books at your bookstore or library, or you've heard her right here on SDPB. Now, for the third time, Dorothy Rosby's words will ring out in a theater. The Well Done Players at the Black Hills Community Theater perform essays from Rosby's 'Tis the Season to Feel Inadequate. That's on October 12th and 13th. Rosby and David DeChristopher, director of the Well Done Players, joined us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City.
Well, I started, actually, I was in Toastmasters a million years ago. Well, I still am, but I did a lot of humorous speaking. And at some point, I won some contests, and at some point, I decided I'm going to write those down, and I sent them to the local paper, and I pitched them a column, and they took it, and after that I started self-syndicating. And so really it was humorous speaking that led me into doing more writing.
Yeah, and humorous speaking has that instant feedback loop, right?
which is very different. And that's one thing I really love about the shows, is that I get to see how the audience reacts to what's been written. Yeah.
Dave DeChristopher, tell us a little bit about the show and how you pull Dorothy's essays from this most recent book and put them on a stage.
Well, this is actually the third time we've adapted her, and I'm very excited. So we sort of, in the group that is going to perform it, we sort of read them at our weekly meetings and pick the ones we like best. And then we have a fairly strenuous rehearsal period, just trying to capture her voice and drilling down a little bit to get the rhythms of everything and speak as one voice.
Mm. Say more about that. You're capturing her voice, but yet you're also performing as an actor. Help us understand the nuances of that.
Well, it's a reading, even though it's well rehearsed. And so we have like three or four ladies sort of sharing off each individual essay in pieces. So one of the challenges is to flow from one to the other while capturing a spirit that is consistent.
How did you guys meet?
Well, when I came to South Dakota in 2018, the ladies who I work with were talking about her, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Who's this? So I picked up one of her books, and I was just floored. I'm from Ohio, where Irma Bombeck is from, and I loved her, and Dorothy, to me, is the perfect heir to Irma Bombeck.
Yeah.
So I read the two books that at the time were published, and I got in touch with her and thought it'd be a great foundation for a show, and she was game, so we did it. And we sold out, actually, during a snowstorm.
So how did you choose? What sorts of essays did you think were particularly suited for stage?
Well, because this book covers holidays, we tried not to be redundant. So if we had a Christmas piece, she has several Christmas pieces, for example, we tried to span the entire year. And then it was really just what tickled us the most. Dorothy is also notoriously a chocoholic. So
that's true.
We had to get a couple pieces in there by chocolate.
Right. So. That is true.
Yeah. Dorothy, from your perspective, are you reading, you read for SDPB so well and so eloquently. Are you reading these out loud as you write? Like you've got some radio experience.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that actually does come through. I really try to write like I talk. Yeah. And I don't know if that's normal or if everybody does that, but to me, that just comes naturally to write like I talk. And so listening to the actors, it's always really interesting to hear how they interpret, the way I talk. So that is really fun, actually, yeah.
One of the things that came through in rehearsal for this one, there's a piece about the Super Bowl, and Dorothy talks about being one of 9 or 10 children, having all these brothers. And we just saw that as the perfect mirror to her style of writing, where she is very sweet, but also tends to zing you a little bit with her sassy observations.
Passive aggressive, they call that.
Dorothy, what inspires you to write? I mean, you got to go to the well again and again and again, and the wells can never be dry because this is your job. Tell me about how you keep those ideas coming for the next column.
Well, I guess I write observational humor, so anything really is fodder. Like right this minute, I'm writing about food labels at grocery stores. because they promise a lot. And I find that really fascinating, you know, that this hair product will make you more radiant. And so, you know, really it's just being observational. And I think I've really trained myself to always be observing. Of course, one of the things I observe the most is my own faults and foibles. So self-deprecating humor, you know, is the other thing. But yeah, just being just training myself to observe what's happening. And I've done it for 30 years, so I've had to really train myself. Yeah.
Yeah. For people who don't remember Irma Bombeck, and lots of our listeners remember Irma Bombeck, but if you haven't dipped into her work lately, what about her as a humorist really inspired you and still does?
Well, I think it's that. I mean, she was maybe the first person who showed newspapers that it could be a good thing to focus on humor from the home front. Mm. And she was successful at it. And I don't know that people did that so much before. So she kind of paved the way for the rest of us who do that kind of humor. Humor that, or, you know, life, looking at just everyday routine, ordinary life. She really did that well. And yeah, she's one of my heroes, honestly.
Do you have one of favorites of hers that would be torn out of the newspaper and laminated on your refrigerator, even if metaphorically?
You know, I'd really have to think about that. But one thing, I do go to the Irma Bombeck Writers Workshop every 2 years. They have that happening in Dayton, Ohio, which is her university there, is her alumni, she's an alumni of that. And they have a conference, a humor writing conference, and I go every couple of years, and it's just amazing. And I'm always amazed at how she was just able to pull that off, that humor from the home front, I call it.
Yeah.
finding the funny in what's so ordinary.
Right. And I think of a columnist like Dave Barry, and one of my favorite Dave Barry columns was, they made a potato gun, and they went to, like, the top of the newspaper office, and they started launching things off, and then Barbie goes out of the, you know, they get a Barbie doll, and they're like, what should we launch next other than a potato? Well, it should be Barbie. And it was a lot of humor that was based on, like, what you can get away with in Florida or what these newspaper reporters could get away with in a newsroom. And that was the key to his humor in so many ways. But when I think of an Irma Bombeck or your work, I think of just like the world that's happening to you, you know, the food label, the politics, the, you know, the political arguments and what people say to you and, you know, how the washing machine works. It's a much more, so when you say humor from the home front, I think of like, yeah, domestic humor in a way that just is the everyday thing. That navigating life is just funny.
It is, yeah.
You don't have to have a potato gun to make a funny story, is what I'm trying to get at.
Exactly, and it's you're training yourself to see that. You know, everything stressful is actually a great story later. If it's really crappy, it makes a great story later.
Dave, tell me about what's in it for performers who say, like, you know, yeah, there is value in just getting up and reading and rehearsing and understanding the text and being together.
Well, it's all of those things, and it's also the camaraderie of the group. I mean, we've done other performances besides Dorothy, but it's really, when you're in an ensemble, you become a family of sorts as well, and everyone is very supportive of one another and working hard to get it just right.
Why are the holidays so, darn funny?
Thanksgiving and Christmas. Dorothy just eviscerates them. My favorite is the Christmas songs, all the Christmas songs that you hate.
Yeah,
that is wonderful.
I do. Yeah, there are several that I don't care for. And because it was my book, I got to say what I thought about them. People may feel differently, but it was my book. And it's your show, so you get to.
Why do we need humor in these times? Having a column in a newspaper that's funny could sound to some people quaint.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet I find it so essential. Why is humor so essential, and why is a local newspaper then so essential?
Well, you were talking about stress. I think it's the reliever of stress and the recognition that you're not alone in your stress about everyday things that are bothersome.
Yeah, yeah. And it takes your mind off things a little bit, too, I think. Also, maybe when you see the foolishness that somebody else, me, for example, has done, then you can look at yourself a little less seriously. I always hope that. Otherwise, I'm oversharing. But I do hope that people can look at themselves differently. You know, what I do, they may have done also.
Right. And just sitting back and listening to a staged reading. Dave, tell me a little bit about what the audience experiences.
It's wonderful because it can approximate listening to the radio, which is very relatable to everybody. You can abandon yourself completely to the voice of what you're listening to.
Yeah. Do we remember how to do that? I think so. People who are listening to this show remember, but I suppose maybe somebody has forgotten and they're not listening anymore.
It's a good lesson to relearn.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Relearn how to listen to one another. Will you read something for us, Dorothy?
Oh, yeah, I will.
What do you think we should do?
This is called Suffering for Suffrage. Elections bring out the worst in people, just like thunderstorms bring out earthworms and manure piles bring out flies. To save you some heartache, I'm going to gaze into my crystal ball and tell you exactly what's going to happen between now and the next election, and that way you can take a vacation from social media and cable news until it's all over but the voting. First, we'll have the candidates who are motivated by power, greed, or a chance to see themselves on a billboard. But some are running for office because they sincerely want to make the world better, and I, for one, am grateful they're willing to run. I cannot imagine the courage and stamina it takes to survive that gauntlet that is a political campaign. I just watch, and I can barely stand it. And the campaigns will be as brutal as ever. Candidates will have access to the most expensive free speech money can buy, and how will they use it? They'll recount every mistake their opponent has made since fifth grade, call them dim-witted evildoers or worse, and then challenge them to run a positive campaign focusing on the issues. Then there's us, the electorate. Though electorate is a funny name to call us when the only electing many of us do is electing not to take part. I know you vote, though, and I do, and we both mind our manners, too, but as we near the election, plenty of people we know will behave as badly as the party they think behaves so badly. Social media users will rant and rave and share stories so bizarre they could only come from tabloid journalists, Russian fiction writers, or the other candidates' campaign staff. Some of their friends will like what they post, and some will unfriend them, and some will threaten to move to Canada if the other side wins, much to the pleasure of the other side and the dismay of the Canadians. One side will tune into cable news channel A, and the other side will tune into cable news channel B, just to reassure themselves they're still right about everything. There will be news, and there will be fake news, and there will be much disagreement about which is which. Watching all of this, you will be convinced that great waves of stupid are washing over this great land. But take heart. Eventually, election day will arrive, and not a moment too soon. If the campaign went on any longer, we'd all spontaneously combust. Some people will vote, many will not, and in the end, someone will win. I'm sorry my crystal ball doesn't tell me who, but it does tell me that billions of dollars will have been spent on campaigns, enough to repair every road and bridge in the country, bring every school up to par, and pay every politician's legal bills. The two sides will finally agree on one thing. They're happy it's over, for now, and no one will move to Canada, much to the relief of the Canadians. They've seen how we act during election years.
I love that. Dorothy Rossby, just what we need as early voting is underway in South Dakota. Dave, tell us about the events and where people can find tickets.
Oh, my goodness. It's next Saturday and Sunday, the 12th and the 13th at 2. And you can order tickets by showing up in person at our box office, which is open from 12 to 5, or by calling or going on our website.
Find tickets and showtimes online at bhct.org. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. Our videographer is Jordan Henderson. Our engineer is Colton Nicholson. If you can't tune in live to In the Moment, subscribe to the In the Moment podcast. Find it on any podcast platform. And you can also connect with us on Instagram at SDPB News. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.